Hey, Prime members, you can listen to Tides of History ad-free on Amazon Music. Download the app today.
Gray clouds hung low in the sky, thick and threatening. Snow swirled downward, caught in the grip of a howling northern wind. It was December 30th, 1460. It was time for a king to die. Or, at least, the man who would be king. Richard, Duke of York, heir to the English throne and one of the most powerful nobles in England, was forced to his knees on a muddy and blood-soaked battlefield. The soldiers holding Richard captive pulled off his helmet and jammed a rough paper crown down onto his head. It made a mockery of his claims to the throne, a mockery reinforced by the jeers and shouts of his captors. There had been a battle here, and the Duke of York had lost. The corpses of his friends and supporters, one of them his 17-year-old son, littered the ground. The Lancastrians, supporters of Queen Margaret of Anjou and her feckless husband, King Henry VI, had won. The Lancastrians had called it rebellion. Richard had called it pursuing his rights. No matter what you called it, now Richard would pay the price. One of the soldiers produced a rough wooden stoke, a chopping block. Another forced Richard's head on it, jamming his foot into the Duke's back to keep him down. A third produced a long, two-handed sword, its blade still dripping blood from the battle. Fingers made numb by the icy wind gripped the hilt. The soldier raised the sword high, then brought it all the way down. The Duke's head rolled onto the muddy ground, its eyes still open, still wearing its mocking paper crown. Hi, everybody. From Wondery, welcome to another episode of Tides of History. I'm Patrick Wyman. Thank you for joining me today. That scene we just saw, Richard, Duke of York's beheading, was just one small part of the Wars of the Roses. This conflict would define an entire generation of political life in England. The series of violent incidents that rocked what had once been Europe's most stable kingdom gave rise to a new dynasty, the famous and improbable Tudors. They also inspired some of the greatest and most popular works of fiction, both in the past and today, from Shakespeare's history plays to Game of Thrones. In this episode and the one that follows, we'll explore exactly how three decades of calamity played out. In 1421, England was the most powerful state in Western Europe. Under the brilliant leadership of King Henry V, English armies had inflicted crushing defeats on their French opponents in the latest phase of the Hundred Years' War. For the first time in two centuries, the Duchy of Normandy along the English Channel was firmly in English hands. Most of France north of the Loire River, the entire northern half of the kingdom, including Paris, likewise belonged to England. Thanks to a recent treaty, Henry V was the legitimate heir to the throne of France. When the mentally ill French king, Charles VI, died, the two crowns would be united in Henry's possession. England itself was the most tightly governed and centralized kingdom on the continent. It was overflowing with wealth, waiting to be tapped by sophisticated systems of taxation to support well-equipped, highly disciplined armies of professional soldiers for years at a time. England was in the ascendancy. By 1453, just 32 years later, all of that had come crashing down. In place of the vigorous and accomplished Henry V, reigned his totally incapable son, Henry VI. All of England's possessions in France had been lost. The crown had lost its prestige, its military capabilities, and more money than it could ever hope to repay. Parliament refused to grant taxes. Within England, law and order were breaking down. The nobility was divided. Civil war loomed on the horizon. From 1455 to 1485, bouts of intense violence racked what had once been Europe's most stable and well-governed kingdom. This 30-year period is known as the Wars of the Roses. This time produced some of the bloodiest battles in medieval history, along with some of its most shocking incidents and most infamous characters. It introduced a new dynasty to rule England, the Tudors, who still loom large in our collective historical imagination. Huge chunks of the English nobility's greatest families were simply wiped out. It's important to understand from the very beginning what the Wars of the Roses were and were not. First, the Wars of the Roses were not a time of constant violence and anarchy. Open civil war was sporadic and mostly occurred in a few major bursts, in 1459 to 1461, 1469 to 1471, and basically by accident again in 1485. Second, the Wars of the Roses were not a revolution. The political system of England was remarkably durable, even in the face of repeated conflict. Its basic structures continued pretty much unchanged. These are key points, but they don't mean that the wars were unimportant, that they have nothing to tell us, or that nothing changed. The battles themselves were shocking to both English and foreign observers in their ferocity and their scale. Towton, in 1461, was the bloodiest ever fought on English soil and may have been the bloodiest single battle of the entire Middle Ages. What's remarkable is that civil war and thousands upon thousands of deaths, repeated over and over, was possible within the confines of a generally stable political system. The simmering, long-term tensions and vicious outbreaks of violence that characterized this period weren't wild exceptions to the usual order of things. Instead, they were the natural product of the system itself. The forces that gave rise to the Wars of the Roses were built in. Built into the behavioral norms and expectations of the people who participated in them, and built into the institutions that channeled that behavior. The Wars of the Roses tell us both how the system was supposed to work and how it failed to work. The story of the Wars of the Roses begins a long time before anyone had ever heard of the Tudors or the Battle of Bosworth. It even goes back to before Henry V, that all-conquering king we saw back in 1421. The real story here begins in 1399 with the deposition of King Richard II. If you've ever read Shakespeare's Richard II, he's the one that says, "Let us sit around and tell sad stories of the deaths of kings." That guy. Henry Bolingbroke, the Duke of Lancaster and the grandson of the great English King Edward III, returned to England from exile and knocked his tyrannical cousin Richard II off the throne. Richard conveniently died shortly afterward, leaving Henry, now Henry IV, to find a way to unite and rule over a realm that was deeply suspicious of him. This was the first deposition of an English king in 70 years, since Edward III and his mother got rid of his underwhelming father, Edward II. This was also the first time a king hadn't been followed onto the throne by his son in 250 years. All that's to say that this was a major shock to what had been an exceptionally stable political system. It raised important issues of authority and legitimacy that would echo throughout the entire 15th century. Henry IV was never entirely secure on the throne, but the bottomless talents of his son Henry V more than made up for any lingering questions about the rule of what were now the Lancastrian kings. Medieval rulers were supposed to do exactly two things: deliver justice and make war. Henry V did both of those better than any other king of this entire period. By 1421, he had restored order in England after his father's chaotic reign. More important, he had laid the French low in both shocking battlefield victories and long, grinding sieges. Thanks to his agreement to marry the daughter of that mentally ill French king, Charles VI, the English crown was poised to fully take over the French. By doing so, Henry would make good on a claim that had mostly rung hollow since Edward III first made it a century before. And then disaster struck. Henry was taken ill while besieging yet another French stronghold and died in August of 1422. His marriage to the French princess, Catherine de Valois, had produced one son, also named Henry. Young Henry was just 3 months old when his father died, and he would have to rule both England and France. The accident of Henry V's early death and the kind of king his son would grow up to be, well, those were the seeds that eventually sprouted into the Wars of the Roses. It's a marker of how strong the English political system was that nobody ever considered anything other than a 3-month-old infant succeeding to the throne. Henry V had made detailed plans for how the realm should be governed until his son came of age. Luckily for the young Henry, and for England, Henry V had been surrounded by a group of exceptionally capable soldiers and officials. Henry V had 2 brothers, John, Duke of Bedford, and Humphrey, Duke of Gloucester. And both were more than competent, especially John, the Duke of Bedford. The burden of safeguarding English interests in occupied France fell to Bedford. Gloucester and a coterie of other public servants were to keep watch in England. This was workable, at least for a while. There were occasional flare-ups of discontent, as you might expect. But for the most part, Bedford's brilliant leadership in France and the Regency Council in England were able to paper over the problem of having a king who was too young to actually rule. By 1437, when Henry VI was 15 years old, it was time for him to step up and start to rule in his own right. He was of reasonable height, perhaps 5'10", and slim. Wide-spaced eyes and a weak chin accentuated his round, boyish face. The young king had received as good an education as the 15th century could provide. He could read and write with equal fluency in English and French. His personality was sober and solemn, and he was already showing deeply pious instincts. What Henry was not, even at this stage, was firm and decisive. In fact, timidity and malleability were his defining characteristics. He preferred, whenever possible, to let others make the decisions for him. This would remain the case for his entire life. It's why 1437 marks the beginning of the long-term political crisis that defines this whole era. The reason for this has to do with the nature of English government. This was monarchy, and the king ruled. It sounds basic, but it's worth repeating. The king ruled. He was supposed to do so with the best interests of his subjects in mind. He was supposed to consult with his nobles and achieve consensus on policy with their input. He was supposed to call Parliament to make laws and raise taxes. But even with all of that in mind, the king was still supposed to rule. Royal authority was the basic driving force of medieval government. The structures and institutions of government, law courts, the exchequer, the chancery, all of it, existed to help the king do the things he wanted to do. They didn't form a bureaucratic machine that could act of its own accord, shambling on and carrying out business in the absence of a directing force. Instead, government simply channeled and enabled royal authority. It took for granted that there would be a royal will at the center of it. From the bottom up, there was a ton of demand for government services, for everything from mediating property disputes to prosecuting crimes. Those institutions of royal government had grown to help the king meet that increasing demand from his subjects. But the fundamental problem was that all of that required an active royal will to set the machine in motion. Somebody had to make the key decisions. Somebody had to decide how the balance of power and prestige within the realm would tilt through legal rulings and inheritances. Somebody had to decide what strategy to take in sensitive political negotiations with touchy, wily Dukes of Burgundy. Somebody had to decide how to ask Parliament for taxation to pay for a military expedition to France. Somebody had to decide where that expedition would go and who would lead it. Henry VI could not make those decisions as a child, so the Regency Council did it for him. All things considered, they did as good a job as anybody could imagine. But even with France largely in disarray, it was a tall order for a smaller kingdom to occupy and control a larger one. That tenuous situation finally disintegrated in 1436 with a pair of nearly simultaneous blows. First, the death of Henry VI's uncle, John, Duke of Bedford, and second, the end of the alliance with the powerful Dukes of Burgundy. After that, the war in France was basically lost. It was just a matter of time and how much dignity and territory the English could extract in a peace deal with the new French king, Charles VII. That, more than anything else, was why adult rule was foisted on a 15-year-old Henry VI in 1437. He was quite obviously not ready for it. Henry's counselors had to know that there was something not quite right about the boy king, even at this stage. He was vacant when they tried to communicate with him, just totally limp, absent, and paralyzed in the face of his responsibilities. This, right here, was the central problem of the English political system. Royal government required Henry VI to make decisions. He was categorically, permanently incapable of doing that, either as a child or as an adult. Henry's incapability was a poison that seeped outward from his person into the royal household, and from there into royal government and the kingdom as a whole. This was a slower and more subtle poison than the tyrannical rule of a bad king like Richard II, but it was every bit as damaging. Still, at this stage, Henry VI's advisors probably thought that the 15-year-old would grow into the role, given time and direction. When that didn't happen, a workaround had to be found. Remember, somebody had to make decisions. For most of the 1440s, that person was William de la Pole, the Duke of Suffolk. Suffolk had fought in France, though not with much success. This inclined him toward a negotiated settlement with the French rather than the pursuit of total victory. Through a close relationship with Henry VI and effective control over the royal household, Suffolk made himself the power behind the throne and the key decision maker in England. The results of Suffolk's surrogate rule were mixed. Somebody was making necessary decisions, which was good, but it wasn't the king, and that was the central issue. The major problem of Henry VI's reign was the war in France. Kings were supposed to make war, and war bound together the king and his nobles with a common sense of purpose and direction. Since war was expensive, it had to be paid for, which meant taxation through Parliament. This too created a sense of national political community, of general investment in the conflict, because Parliament's agreement to be taxed implied agreement to participate in war. But Henry, because of his basic vacancy, couldn't do any of that. He wasn't going to be leading an army into battle. His personal relationships with the nobles didn't extend beyond his immediate household, and he wasn't going to be making any sort of convincing case to Parliament. This meant that the English were stuck with a war that the most powerful nobles wanted nothing to do with, and Parliament didn't want to pay for. It was difficult to find competent commanders and troops willing to sign up. It was even harder to find the wages to pay them. Suffolk tried to direct the war and find a way around these huge obstacles, but there were other voices arguing for different solutions. The king's uncle Humphrey, the Duke of Gloucester, wanted nothing more than all-out war. The powerful Beaufort family, more on them a little bit later, had ambitions of their own and led a disastrous expedition to central France in 1443 that wasted precious money and resources. Richard, the Duke of York, took over as the king's lieutenant in France in 1440 and held the post for 5 years. Richard did his best under brutal circumstances. As you might expect from that scene at the beginning, we'll be hearing much more from Richard, Duke of York, a little bit later. Finally, in 1446, Suffolk found a solution. He negotiated a marriage between Henry VI and the cousin of the French king, Margaret of Anjou. Suffolk used that to cement a peace deal with King Charles VII of France. Some of the French possessions would be ceded back to King Charles. Maybe, just maybe, the English would be able to hold on to Gascony and Normandy. The peace deal failed after just a few short years. In July of 1449, Normandy fell to Charles VII in an almost bloodless conquest. Rather than face the terrifying prospect of bombardment by Charles's cannons, the Normans opened the gates of their towns and castles and surrendered. They were simply fed up with English rule, which had turned expensive, repressive, and unpopular. The loss of Normandy was the key turning point in the reign of Henry VI, because it made obvious to everybody, not just the king's closest counselors, what the fundamental problem in England actually was. The king, on a very basic level, was completely incompetent. England was in crisis. That crisis had been brewing for quite some time. The loss of Normandy was just a visible manifestation of it. On a deeper level, it had been going on for some time, all driven by the fact that Henry VI was just incapable of ruling. Suffolk had done his best, but the way he had granted out royal offices and estates, the rewards a ruler could dangle to gain support, couldn't help but be partisan. This has traditionally been seen as Suffolk's great failing. If he had been more even-handed with the spoils of government, maybe he could have maintained support. But in reality, he was faced with an impossible task. He just wasn't the king. Anything Suffolk did was going to seem partisan. An office or an estate granted to one person or one family meant that it wasn't granted to another. This was a zero-sum game. The reason Normandy fell so quickly in July of 1449 was because Parliament had refused to grant taxation to raise an army to defend it. After 13 years of constant failures, why would Parliament allow the crown to dip its hand into the nation's pockets for yet another, probably useless, campaign? When Normandy fell, so too did Suffolk. He was blamed for the disaster and impeached by Parliament for supposed treason in his dealings with the French. Suffolk hadn't actually committed treason, but really it didn't matter. Parliament was right that the series of missteps had mostly emanated from Suffolk. There were thousands of refugees from Normandy streaming into England. Soldiers who had garrisoned the towns and castles, artisans who had made a living there, minor nobles who had held land, a whole class of Englishmen dispossessed after an entire generation. Somebody had to pay for that disaster. That somebody ended up being Suffolk. Henry VI commuted Suffolk's punishment to exile. And on April 30th, 1450, the Duke took ship for the continent. He didn't get very far. The very next day, a ship called the Nicholas met the Duke and brought him on board. "Welcome, traitor," the captain told him. The crew of the Nicholas held their own tribunal and found Suffolk guilty of treason. He was then taken ashore. Quote, There was an axe and a stoke, a chopping block, and one of the lewdest of the ship bade him lay down his head and took a rusty sword and smote off his head within half a dozen strokes. 2 days later, a body was found on Dover Beach. The Duke of Suffolk's head was impaled next to it on a pole. That wasn't the end of the Troubles. Around the same time, a massive popular rebellion broke out, Cade's Rebellion. From southeastern England, a large group of rebels marched on London, where they dragged out and executed the royal treasurer, Lord Say, and the sheriff of Kent. This was no rabble. They articulated a sophisticated critique of the obvious failings of royal government under Henry VI. They decried the siphoning off of crown financial resources. They shouted down bad officials. They pointed to problems with the application of justice and much, much more. Cade's rebels were put down in July of 1450, but their assessment of England's ills had been spot on. The inert, incapable kingship of Henry VI had caused a full-blown crisis of authority.
If you travel, you know when it comes to love.
See you soon.
Can't wait.
The sky is no limit. You know with your Delta Amex card, being oceans apart means meeting in Aruba. And booking a war travel with your card means saving 15% on Delta flights. You know kissing under the bridge of sighs guarantees eternal love. Because you're the long-distance lovebirds. It's why you're a Delta SkyMiles Platinum American Express card member. If you travel, you know. Take off 15 discount not applicable to partner-operated flights or taxes and fees. Terms apply. Visit go.amex/you know.
If I asked you how many subscriptions you have, would you be able to list all of them and how much you're paying? If you would have asked me this question before I started using Rocket Money, I would have said yes. But let me tell you, I would have been so wrong. I can't believe how many I had and all the money I was wasting. Rocket Money is a personal finance app that finds and cancels your unwanted subscriptions, monitors your spending, and helps lower your bills. Rocket Money has over 5 million users and has helped save its members an average of $720 a year with over 500 million in canceled subscriptions. Stop wasting money on things you don't use. Cancel your unwanted subscriptions by going to rocketmoney.com/Wondery. That's rocketmoney.com/Wondery. rocketmoney.com/Wondery.
July 17th, 1453 began as a promising day for John Talbot, the Earl of Shrewsbury. The old Earl was now 66 years old, a veteran of dozens of campaigns and some of the most vicious battles of the Hundred Years' War. Sometimes called the English Achilles, Talbot physically embodied the English military reputation that had been won at such great cost during the time of Henry V and his brother John, the Duke of Bedford. Talbot was the last great soldier left from that passing generation. He had come to France one last time to recover a seemingly hopeless situation. Against all odds and expectations, Talbot had been successful. Here in Gascony, in southwestern France, he had retaken the key port city of Bordeaux and had secured most of the surrounding countryside. Now, Talbot thought, he had the French army exactly where he wanted them. The French were laying siege to the town of Castillon, some 26 miles east of Bordeaux. Talbot would march out and relieve the garrison. If he could annihilate the smallest of the three French armies currently invading Gascony, he could buy time for more reinforcements to reach him from England, and then begin the long campaign of reconquest. But instead of facing a small and outmatched French force that was running away from him in fear, Talbot found himself looking across an open field at an entrenched enemy army. Sunlight glistened off the barrels of cannons and the blades of swords and pole arms. Maybe it was innate aggressiveness. Maybe it was the ideals of chivalry. Maybe it was just a simple lapse of judgment. For whatever reason, Talbot ordered his army to attack across that open ground. It was a slaughter. The booming of cannon, as many as 300 guns, was quickly followed by the screams of dead and dying Englishmen. Shot tore through their ranks, killing as many as 6 men with a single shot. By the end of the day, more than 4,000 English soldiers were dead, wounded, or captured. Talbot himself was dead. He had been pinned under his dying horse and dispatched with an axe. His body was so badly disfigured that it could only be identified the next day by the heraldic badge he wore. Bordeaux fell several months later, leaving the port of Calais as the last tiny island of English territory in France. Nobody knew it just yet, but the Hundred Years' War was finally over. Several weeks after Talbot's mangled body was identified amid the heaps of dead and dying on the field at Castillon, word of the defeat reached King Henry VI. The news shattered the king. According to one source, he, quote, suddenly was taken and smitten with a frenzy and his wit and reason withdrawn. Henry had fallen into a catatonic stupor. He was unable to speak, eat, or move. His reign had, in some sense, been vacant since he first took the throne as a child. Now, in August of 1453, he was well and truly gone. The years since Jack Cade's rebellion in 1450 had been ones of serious strain on the kingdom as a whole. Henry's catatonia in 1453 was a physical encapsulation of the crisis of authority England was facing. It was obvious that the things done in Henry's name were not the product of Henry's will. So, who would get to make those decisions? This was the central question that dominated the 3 years between Suffolk's impromptu execution in 1450 and Henry's descent into mental illness in 1453. Two contenders had emerged, each of them relying on different bases of support. The first of these was Edmund Beaufort, the Duke of Somerset. He was one of the most exalted noblemen in England, the great-grandson of King Edward III. It was rumored that he'd had an affair with Henry VI's mother, Catherine de Valois, after her husband's death. His time as a soldier in France had seen mixed results. Good during the 1430s, much less so amid the disasters of the 1440s, and Somerset had barely escaped blame for the loss of Normandy in 1449. The base of Somerset's power was, like that of Suffolk, located in the royal household. This was not a literal house, but the collection of subordinates gathered around the immediate person of the king. It included everybody from lowly servants all the way up to major nobles like Somerset. As we talked about, all royal government revolved around the person of the king. The household had immediate access to and influence over the king. This was what made first Suffolk and then Somerset powerful. The second contender was Richard, Duke of York. I mentioned him briefly a little while back. Like Somerset, he too was a great-grandson of King Edward III. He too was one of the most powerful nobles in England. And he too had fought in France. Unlike Somerset, Richard's time in charge in France from 1440 to 1444 hadn't been disastrous. It hadn't been good, exactly, but since he had been the king's lieutenant in Ireland in the late 1440s, Richard had avoided the taint of blame for the final defeat. After Suffolk's fall and Somerset's emergence as the power behind the throne, Richard mounted a challenge. Where Somerset's power was rooted in the private, secretive world of the household, the Duke of York's claim to authority rested on a much different basis. The idea of the public weal or the common good of the kingdom, as expressed by the lesser nobility and the broad political society of England. York was building on and using the idea of good government, what the king was supposed to owe to the people of England. Government in secret, carried out by a tiny clique of courtiers within the household, was not acceptable anymore. York was the face of this movement. Both York and Somerset were ambitious and perhaps even power-hungry political animals. But they both also genuinely believed that they were doing what was best for the kingdom. Both assumed that they had the right to power and the ability to wield it in the absence of a genuine royal will from Henry VI. This was still a crisis of authority, and York and Somerset were trying to fill the vacuum left by Henry VI's inability to act. At first, things swung in York's direction. His return from Ireland was widely lauded, but he went a step too far when he asked Parliament to confirm him as Henry VI's heir. Despite 4 years of marriage to Queen Margaret of Anjou, Henry had yet to produce a son who would follow him on the throne. Given Henry's abhorrence of nakedness and his general lack of physicality, it seemed unlikely that there ever would be an heir. Why should York not be the heir? His claim in blood was, if anything, nearly as good as Henry VI's. In the end, Parliament refused to make York Henry's heir, and the conflict kind of moved on. This was a relatively minor incident considering what followed, but it matters for one major reason. It was the first time legitimacy, by what right a ruler got to rule, appeared as a factor in the ongoing political crisis. Nobody had questioned Henry VI's place before this. Now, questions were starting to seep in. We'll return to this later, so bear it in mind. After York's failure in Parliament, the balance of power shifted back towards Somerset and the household. In order to maintain his position and redress the problems of Suffolk's rule, Somerset pursued a major program of reform. This focused on an act of resumption, which canceled all the royal grants of land and offices that had caused such huge problems for Suffolk. The king, at this point, was broke. The revenue existed, but it had drained into the pockets of Suffolk's allies instead of royal coffers. With the Act of Resumption, that revenue returned to the royal household, and Henry was able to live within his means. This headed off one of the two great issues that had bedeviled Suffolk and royal government. A bigger problem was the breakdown of law and order out in the counties of England. Remember, the king had basically two jobs, making war and delivering justice. Society, particularly aristocratic society, was naturally fractious. It was full of conflicts and potential conflicts. Arguments about the inheritance of some lands, fights about control of a castle, spats about who got to hold an important local office and its revenues. The reason the king's law was so popular, why there was so much demand for it, was because it represented the only external force that could deal with these constant problems. Was it perfect? No, absolutely not. Patronage and connections still helped to determine who actually won these disputes. Folks still went home unhappy. But this was a lot better than relying on local courts that were in the pocket of one of the parties involved in a dispute, or private warfare between families. Those were the only other options in medieval England. They were not attractive. So the king was supposed to be the final, impartial arbiter in these disputes. But what if the king couldn't or wouldn't arbitrate? That was the problem with Henry VI, and it slowly festered over the course of the 1440s. Suffolk had tried to deal with disputes as they came up, but he was a great noble in his own right. Any action he took was in and of itself partisan, because he had allies and retainers and people who were connected to him by patronage. When he picked a side, that was not the king's impartial justice. It was the political act of a major noble. The result was a series of local conflicts that were just getting worse and worse in the absence of royal attention. There were a number of these happening simultaneously all over England, ranging from squabbles among families of local notables over property to more serious disputes between great nobles. One small-scale quarrel in East Anglia involved the famous Paston family of letter writers. One of their estates had been seized by a crony of the Duke of Suffolk, and they repeatedly tried and failed to get royal authorities to do anything about it. On the high end, a private war broke out between the Earl of Devon, a guy named Thomas Courtney, and William Bonneville. This was precisely the kind of thing the king was supposed to mediate, but Henry VI just couldn't do it. Our friend York stepped in, completely unauthorized, to mediate that last feud in 1451, and he eventually spurred Somerset to do the same. As these social frictions began to generate sparks and heat, the conflict between York and Somerset continued to grow. By early 1452, things reached a head. York raised an armed force and marched to London to demand the removal of Somerset. This could very easily have turned into the first battle of the Wars of the Roses, and it really was a turning point. For the first time since 1399, a major noble had raised a private force and was determined to effect a change in government. As it happened, York submitted to negotiation, a general pardon was issued, and the conflict fizzled out. Still, it was clear that there was something deeply wrong. The underlying issues just weren't going away. Somerset's response to York's challenge in 1452 was to turn Henry VI into a simulacrum of an active king. He announced that Henry VI would lead an expedition to retake Gascony. Even though this never actually happened, it marked a major shift from the complacency of Suffolk's reign. Henry VI did make carefully stage-managed tours of some of the areas most beset by unrest and violence, like Kent and the Welsh Marches. It was just enough to make it seem like he was actually doing something. On the foreign front, Somerset found the money to send Talbot and his army to Gascony, where they retook Bordeaux. He also increased the size of the permanent garrison in the port of Calais, which he directly controlled. Meanwhile, Somerset ruthlessly consolidated his power base. Where Suffolk had tried, with some success, to dispense patronage, at least kind of even-handedly, Somerset had no such pretensions. He handed out lands and offices to his most loyal supporters, people like Queen Margaret and the king's half-brothers Jasper and Edmund Tudor. We'll talk more about these Tudors a little bit later. By early 1453, Somerset was feeling increasingly confident. Parliament had agreed to grant substantial taxes. Somerset's backers hounded York supporters wherever they could, and the Duke of York himself couldn't do much about it. But this was where Somerset overstepped and inadvertently laid the foundation for his own eventual downfall. He carved out deep and serious support for his control of Henry VI's government, far deeper than Suffolk's had ever been. But at the same time, Somerset also shattered any illusion that the king's authority was impartial. For practically all of King Henry's long and ineffectual reign, the high nobility of England had been united behind him. Nobody actively questioned Henry VI's right to rule or the legitimacy of his authority. York's attempts to seize government in 1450 and 1452 had failed for exactly this reason, because of a lack of noble support. But now, things were starting to change. Somerset ruled in Henry's name as the leader of a clique, with serious consequences to the king's authority and his legitimacy. Other nobles were being left out. They were increasingly unhappy about that fact. Still, Somerset's strategy seemed to be working. Then came the twin disasters of Talbot's defeat at Castillon and Henry's fall into a catatonic state. Things began to fall apart. Those simmering conflicts in the counties and localities of England exploded into prominence. Two of the great noble families in the north, the Percys and the Nevilles, were on the verge of open war. By favoring the Percys, this was a conflict that Somerset himself had created and stoked. Henry was incapacitated, and there could be no illusion that Somerset was ruling on his behalf. Improbably, Queen Margaret produced a son, a little prince named Edward. Henry VI now had the heir it had seemed so unlikely that he would ever get. Quiet whispers suggested that little Prince Edward was actually Somerset's son, not Henry's. But either way, now Margaret too wanted a piece of the action, to rule as regent on behalf of her young son. Bordeaux fell to the French, leaving only Calais as the sole English possession on the continent. All was chaos. There was exactly one person left in England who had any hope of restoring order. Richard, the Duke of York. This was his opportunity, and he seized it. With the backing of the powerful Neville family, Richard took the role of protector of government. In return, he accepted the creation of Henry's young son as Prince of Wales and eventual heir to the throne. At the same time, Margaret made a case to be regent, but nobody immediately bit. Somerset was tossed in prison on charges of treason. This was Richard's show. But the realm was still divided, and getting more so. The Somerset faction, soon to become the Lancastrians, focused around Henry's wife Queen Margaret and the improbable little Prince Edward, well, that wasn't going away. York's backers, the Nevilles, won a pitched battle against the Percy family in the north and brought some semblance of peace and order back. York, too, was ruling as the leader of a faction, but it was a faction that most of the kingdom's great nobles supported. At least for now. This particular state of affairs could last only as long as Henry was out of commission. Unfortunately for York, Henry woke up on Christmas Day of 1454, after 15 months of catatonia. He had no memory of anything that had happened during his incapacitation, but he seemed none the worse for wear otherwise. At least, he seemed no different than before. Physically present, but otherwise vacant. With Henry capable of serving as a figurehead once more, the tables turned against York with shocking speed. Somerset was released from prison, as was his nasty and mean-spirited ally, the Duke of Exeter. Despite his genuine attempts at governance, York was stripped of all his offices and his friends were forced out. Somerset reestablished himself as the power behind the throne. There was only one option left. As long as Somerset was around, York would never be safe, let alone occupying the position of power he felt was his both by right and by his proven ability. York went north and, together with his Neville allies, started gathering an army. Somerset called a great council to meet in May of 1455, presumably to institutionalize his newly recovered authority. York was having none of it. He immediately marched south toward London with an armed force of 3,000 men. Somerset doesn't seem to have realized the danger. Too late, he started assembling an army of his own. York caught up to Somerset and King Henry at the town of St. Albans, about 20 miles northwest of London, on Thursday, May 22nd. The plan was initially to negotiate. York got his chance to go face-to-face with Somerset and a more neutral intermediary, the Duke of Buckingham. York's basic demand hadn't changed. Somerset should be in prison on charges of treason. Buckingham refused and suggested that York take his army to a nearby town for the night and continue the talks tomorrow. It was then around 10 a.m. St. Albans had no walls, but Somerset's men had thrown up hasty barricades, almost as an afterthought. Nobody really expected a fight. many of Somerset's allies within St. Albans hadn't even thought it necessary to put their armor on. But the Earl of Warwick, Richard Neville, a key ally of York's, got sick of waiting. His men launched an attack on the barricades. At long last, after so many close calls and so many years of simmering tension, the violence had finally begun. It didn't last long. Sword and poleaxe clashed with the steel of armor. Arrows fell like rain. The barriers fell within an hour, and the defenders were forced back inside the town. The narrow streets were soon full of the dead and dying. Among them was Henry Percy, the Earl of Northumberland and the great enemy of the Neville family. Poor King Henry, who knew nothing of war, was grazed by an arrow, much to his shock and dismay. "Forsooth and forsooth," the king said, "you do foully to smite a king anointed so." The Duke of Somerset was pushed back into defending a tavern marked by the sign of a castle. He fought to the last, but eventually, York's men dragged him out into the street and cut him down. The Duke of Somerset was dead, his blood gushing onto the streets of St. Albans. The battle was over. York was triumphant, but the Wars of the Roses were just beginning.
If you travel for work, you know to pack two suits, business and swim. You know with your Delta SkyMiles Business Amex card, buying that plane ticket for a business trip can get you closer to medallion status. You know that a meeting in Montana means visiting almost every national park.
Yellowstone? Check.
Because you're the chief excursion officer. It's why you're a Delta SkyMiles Platinum Business American Express card member. If you travel, you know. Terms apply. Visit go.amex/youknowbusiness.
In light of what came later in the Wars of the Roses, the Battle of St. Albans was a tiny little pinprick. Fewer than 60 out of perhaps 5,000 men involved in the fight were killed. Henry VI wasn't killed or even deposed. In fact, the Yorkist lords bent the knee and swore allegiance to Henry immediately following the battle. But it marked an essential turning point. Somerset was dead. The king's household, the site of government for the past 30 years, was rendered toothless. The king had, quote, granted to be ruled by Yorkist lords whom he had previously proclaimed traitors. The sheer fact of what had happened, open battle between two factions of leading lords just 20 miles from the capital, couldn't be covered up. Something fundamental had snapped in England's political community. In the aftermath, York was ascendant. He pushed a strong reform program in conjunction with Parliament, passing an act of resumption to take back all the offices and lands that Somerset had granted out from the crown to build up his power base. The captaincy of Calais, command of the only permanent standing army in England, went to the Earl of Warwick, Richard Neville, one of York's strongest allies. Calais will be important down the road, so bear it in mind. But, once again, York simply could not hold power. Nasty feuds out in the counties got worse. York went out to restore order, but this was indicative of the broader problems that he simply couldn't solve. Politically, his support for the Act of Resumption meant stripping lands and revenues from powerful lords who got nothing in return except for anger at York. By early 1456, less than a year after St. Albans, York was dismissed once again as protector. Power began to coalesce around Queen Margaret of Anjou. She had during her life, and still has now, a pretty nasty reputation. Much of that was well-earned. But she was also a remarkable woman from a family of remarkable women. Her father, the high-born and ambitious but incredibly feckless nobleman René of Anjou, spent much of his adult life in prison or exile, following a series of failed attempts to carve out a kingdom in Italy. This meant that the women in Margaret's family essentially ruled in their own right for long periods of time. When faced with an obviously incompetent husband and a 3-year-old son, Margaret thought, why couldn't she do the same? The 26-year-old queen had already begun to flex her political muscles during her husband's period of catatonia. Now, she did so again, with vigor and intelligence. Margaret, quite intelligently, built up a substantial base of support around the figure of the young Prince Edward. He was made Prince of Wales and invested with large estates. Estates meant money and armed retainers who could be called upon to fight. The Duchy of Lancaster was a personal possession of the crown, and here too, Margaret began to build a deep and potent power base that stretched across one of England's major regions. Elsewhere, Margaret granted other important magnates land and offices to guarantee their support. The demographic profile of these lords is worth noting. They tended to be young, recently come into their titles. Jasper Tudor, the Earl of Pembroke and Henry VI's half-brother, was typical. He was 25 years old in 1456 and hungry for advancement. Like Jasper, Margaret's clique weren't members of the older generation that had been defined by the Hundred Years' War. They lacked that generation's deep-rooted dedication to presenting a unified noble front to govern the kingdom. What was becoming obvious as Margaret consolidated power was the kingdom's increasing split into two factions. Especially prior to St. Albans, but even after, it had been possible to see the king as the neutral center of government. This was a crisis of authority, and factions could form and fight over who got to wield that authority. But the king was still a symbolic figure that both sides could pursue and use as a stamp of approval for their rule. His basic legitimacy, his right to rule, wasn't really in question, at least not yet. Margaret built on the foundation of the faction Somerset had created, but she was the queen and the keeper of both the king and the heir to the throne. Her position was different than that of the mere power behind the throne, however important Somerset had been. This made Margaret, and by extension the king and the prince, factional figures as well, instead of unifying ones. There had been a great middle group of English nobles, the most important, powerful, and important figures in the kingdom. They had been happy to hang out, kind of in the middle, and seek consensus. Margaret was slowly carving up that middle ground. Nobles were being forced to pick a side. The oddest example of this trend came in 1458, 2 years into Margaret's effective control of government. Following a great council of nobles where York and the Earl of Warwick agreed to pay compensation for the deaths they had caused at St. Albans, King Henry VI pushed for a public reconciliation. This was one of the few things throughout his long reign that we can say Henry personally advocated for. Predictably, given Henry's general level of competence, this was a disaster. The public ceremony of reconciliation was called Love Day, and it called for each of the two sides' lords to walk arm in arm with the person on the other side they hated the most. The young Duke of Somerset, nearly killed at St. Albans and the son of the murdered Duke, was paired with the old Neville Earl of Salisbury. The Earl of Warwick, York's greatest supporter, went with the wily and nasty Duke of Exeter. The final pair consisted of the Duke of York and Queen Margaret. Last came King Henry himself, perhaps the most ridiculous figure of all. This parade of people who had murdered friends, allies, and relatives who wanted nothing more than to destroy each other traipsed through the streets of London in full view of the public. As friend of the show Dan Jones points out in his book on the Wars of the Roses, the Love Day forced some of the most powerful people in the realm to relive incredibly traumatic events. It placed them on opposite sides and essentially acknowledged that England's political society was irrevocably split into two factions that had good reason to hate each other. Far from healing that divide, the Love Day highlighted it and sharpened it. It was completely fitting that one of Henry VI's few personal acts was somehow even more damaging than the lack of them had been. What Margaret's actions as effective regent and Henry's at the Love Day had done was to cut away that potential middle ground for England's nobility. It was increasingly hard to just say, well, the king should rule, and that's it, since the king was an increasingly partisan figure. The crisis of authority had been going on for pretty much King Henry's entire reign. Now, the crisis of legitimacy was getting worse, too. If the king wasn't the king for everybody, but for a faction, then was he really the legitimate king? Should he really be ruling at all? At the moment, this was mostly a question for the high nobility, the between 80 and 100 people who held major titles at any given time, like the Duke of Exeter, Earl of Warwick, Duke of York, and their immediate families. But this had major consequences further down the social scale, too, extending to the gentry. There were far more gentry than nobles in England, maybe 7,000 of them in total. Collectively, the gentry held more land than the much smaller number of nobles. The gentry held local offices, they administered law and kept order, and they often did military service. The nature of society tied them very closely to those great nobles, to their social superiors. This meant that increasing polarization at the top radiated downwards throughout political society as a whole. Many gentry had ties to several different nobles simultaneously. They might administer an estate here, hold an office from another there, and be sworn to do military service for another. So, Just as the nobles were picking sides during Queen Margaret's regency, so too were the gentry. This made it harder to get closure on the hundreds of local squabbles that were going on at any given time. Arguments about inheritance, about land, about office holding that needed either a noble or the king to adjudicate. In the absence of that theoretically impartial higher authority, these conflicts got nastier and nastier, more and more violent. In this way, the instability at the top of the political system was spreading more broadly and more deeply through society as a whole. Queen Margaret succeeded in removing practically all of the Duke of York's appointees from office except for one, Richard Neville, the Earl of Warwick, who was still captain of the Calais garrison. This small port was England's sole remaining possession in France. It was a lonely reminder of past English power. Calais was small, it was expensive to maintain, but it was essential for two reasons. First, it was England's only standing military force, and as such, it was a key bulwark against a still hostile France. Second, it was the destination for all of England's wool exports. It was called the Calais staple. This was where customs dues were assessed and collected. This made Calais a linchpin of both the economy in general, since wool was its key product, and state finance in particular. Whoever controlled Calais, as the Earl of Warwick did after 1456, was bound to be a key player if the political situation deteriorated. And, unsurprisingly, that's exactly what happened when Margaret went about building her factional power base. From his base in Calais, Warwick built close connections with the powerful and wealthy merchants of London who regularly did business in the Channel port. The Earl also used Calais as a base for profitable piracy. He attacked Spanish, German, and Italian shipping. He took in great hauls of money and loot that paid the garrison and ensured their loyalty to him personally. The London merchants saw those foreigners as competition, and they applauded Warwick's actions, even as they helped to destabilize the political situation in England itself. Finally, late in 1458, just 6 months after the Love Day, matters once again began to spiral out of control. For the past year, following a serious French raid on the English port of Sandwich, Henry VI had been attempting to negotiate a final peace with France. This would, he hoped, bring a final end to the conflict that had mostly been over since Talbot had been blasted by French cannon at Castillon in 1453. But Warwick and the Duke of York wanted a say in foreign policy. They carried out their own negotiations with France and Burgundy, the other major player. It was York's sons who would be used as marriageable assets in any peace deal. Understandably, he and his supporters wanted a say. This was unacceptable to Queen Margaret and her faction. So were Warwick's actions in Calais, which endangered any potential peace. The Queen wanted Warwick out of Calais and for the Duke of York to submit to whatever deal she and her supporters negotiated with the French. As things got worse, the Queen and her faction were determined not to be taken by surprise, as they had been at St. Albans in 1455. They ordered armaments and began assembling an army, while York and Warwick retreated from court. Warwick barely survived a brawl between his Calais men and members of the king's household. This was either a direct assassination attempt on the Earl or a plot to get him in enough trouble that he could be taken into prison. Queen Margaret planned a great council for June of 1459 and summoned all the nobles of the realm. There was more than a hint of menace here. A royal army had already been assembled. When York and the Nevilles, including the Earl of Warwick, refused to attend, the Yorkists were denounced. The next step for the Queen was obviously to declare them traitors and seize their lands and titles. In late summer of 1459, York, the Earl of Warwick, and Warwick's father, the Earl of Salisbury, put together their own army. Salisbury led it, heading south toward London. A royal army gathered to meet it. The English political system had completely disintegrated. Open conflict was the only possible outcome. The Wars of the Roses had officially begun. How had this come to pass? Was it the Queen's deep hostility toward the Duke of York and the Earl of Warwick? Was it York's ambition and the Earl of Warwick's provocations? Or was it something outside these major players, namely the growing instability, feuding, and violence between the other great nobles of England? The historian Gerald Harris points out that all of these things were symptoms of the same problem, the inability of the nobles to agree on a substitute for King Henry VI's rule. Harris writes, quote, "Kingship was the linchpin of the state. Its unique authority could not be counterfeited, and once it failed, political society fell apart." It had taken a long time for the players in England's political community to truly wrap their heads around this concept. By 1459, 37 years, most of an entire generation, had passed since a king had actually wielded royal authority in his own right. In fact, most of the current political leadership of England had no direct experience of what royal rule was supposed to look like. What's amazing is not that things finally snapped. It's that it took so long for it to happen. The Earl of Salisbury met the royal army in battle at a place called Bloor Heath. Salisbury was outnumbered, but he drew the royal commander Lord Audley into an ill-considered attack across a stream and into wooded ground. Audley was cut down and Salisbury triumphed, leaving some 2,000 men dead and dying on the field. The first major battle of the Wars of the Roses had gone in the direction of the Yorkists. But their triumph was short-lived. Salisbury's army, what remained of it after Bloor Heath, was drastically outnumbered by royal forces. In October of 1459, the Yorkist lords were left with no choice but to flee England. They left behind their army to beg pardons from the Queen. Richard, Duke of York, went to Ireland with his younger son, Edmund. The Earl of Warwick and his father, Salisbury, went to the safety of Calais with York's older son, a boy named Edward. For the moment, York and the Nevilles had very little support within the broader political community. When Queen Margaret and her supporters summoned a parliament at Coventry, most of the nobles of England were behind them. Margaret branded the Yorkists as traitors and attainted them. An attainder was a fearsome legal penalty. It meant that the Yorkists' lands were confiscated and their heirs were forever disbarred from inheritance. This was the obvious step for Margaret, but in openly acknowledging civil war, it meant that what she controlled was just as much a faction as her enemies. At this point, we can start to call them Lancastrians. Even more than before, the Lancastrians acted like a faction. The Queen's allies received the Yorkists' lands and offices to ensure their loyalty. Royal commissions brutalized and intimidated Yorkist sympathizers out in the counties of England. The Duke of York and the Nevilles didn't stay out of England for long. In the winter of 1459 and the spring of 1460, they organized and gathered their resources. On June 26, 1460, the Earl of Warwick, his father the Earl of Salisbury, and York's son Edward landed in Kent with a strong force of experienced soldiers drawn from the Calais garrison. Once again, the Queen and her faction were taken by surprise, not just by the speed of the Yorkist advance toward Coventry, but by the depth of their support. The Duke of Norfolk had rallied to York's cause. Even the son of the royal commander killed at Bloor Heath, Lord Audley, was on York's side. The Archbishop of Canterbury, the highest churchman in England, led a strong contingent of bishops on York's side. Queen Margaret's actions were generating backlash. On July 7th, a rainy, miserable day, the two armies met in battle at Northampton. The Yorkists had the numbers and the tactical advantage, and settled on a vicious but highly intelligent strategy. Rather than indiscriminately killing Lancastrian soldiers, they attacked only their leaders. The result was a highly targeted massacre of key Lancastrian supporters. The Duke of Buckingham, a prominent Percy, one of the Neville's great enemies, the Earl of Shrewsbury, and many other high nobles were all left dead on the battlefield. In addition to the metaphorical scalps they collected, the Yorkists also nabbed an important symbolic prize. The harmless King Henry VI, sitting there amid the carnage, just as he had at St. Albans 5 years earlier. King Henry had refused to leave his tent. After his allies captured Henry VI at Northampton, the Duke of York switched strategies. Rather than claiming to be ruling in Henry's name, York made a claim on the throne himself. He was saying that he, not poor, feckless King Henry, should be the ruler. Failing that, at least he should formally be made Henry's heir. Little Prince Edward should be disinherited. This was a clear strike against Queen Margaret, who was now claiming power as her son's regent after her husband's capture. Parliament, the other lords, and the bishops didn't buy York's claim on the throne, but it was manifestly obvious at this point that Henry's authority was just shot. They compromised and made York Henry's heir. The Queen and the young prince were now the traitors and the rebels. In December of 1460, York headed north to finish off the Queen and her supporters. He brought with him the Earl of Salisbury, Warwick's father, and his second son Edmund, the Earl of Rutland. This was a major miscalculation. Margaret had raised a powerful army with shocking speed, and practically overnight, it hemmed in York and Salisbury at a castle in East Yorkshire. What York did next was even more of a mistake. He rode out with a small force to relieve a foraging party that Lancastrian soldiers had attacked and very quickly found himself surrounded. After an hour of hard fighting, York was overcome. Desperate, he ordered his younger son Edmund to flee for safety. The 17-year-old Edmund very nearly made it. He was caught by a certain Lord Clifford, the son of a man killed at St. Albans 5 years earlier. Clifford stabbed Edmund through the heart, quote, "as your father slew mine." Meanwhile, the Duke of York himself was captured. Out came the chopping block and the rough paper crown, and down came the blade of the sword. York's head rolled onto the ground, and the man who would have been king was dead. The Earl of Salisbury and one of his sons, the brother of the Earl of Warwick, were also captured. They too were beheaded. All of the heads were sent to the city of York, where they were displayed atop a gate for all the world to see. The Duke of York's head still bore its paper crown. Queen Margaret's faction had torn the heart out of the Yorkists. Their figurehead, the Duke of York, was dead. The Earl of Salisbury was dead. York's second son was dead. But two men remained at large. The first was Richard Neville, the Earl of Warwick, captain of Calais, and a gangrenous sore in Queen Margaret's side. Warwick held London with substantial forces. The second man who remained at large was a handsome, charismatic giant of an 18-year-old, Edward, the Earl of March, son and heir of the murdered Duke of York. With his father's death, Edward now inherited his father's duchy, his claim on the throne, and an open civil war. The Wars of the Roses were well and truly underway. Next time on Tides of History, we'll complete our exploration of the Wars of the Roses, so be sure to check back for the conclusion of this story. Until then, thanks for joining me. Be sure and drop me a line if you'd like to chat about the fall of the Roman Empire or the rise of the modern world. You can find me on Twitter at Patrick_Wyman or on Facebook at Patrick Wyman MMA. You can follow the show at Tides History. Tides of History is written and narrated by me, Patrick Wyman. The sound engineer is Sergio Enriquez. Tides of History is produced by Leah Sutherland. From Wondery, the executive producer is Hernan Lopez. Thanks again for listening. Until next time, from Wondery, this has been Tides of History.
Business can mean a lot of things. For some, it's earning reports, the top MBA program, investments, but business isn't everything we do. Side hustles that explode into the next billion-dollar company.
I need to create my own product that I control what the marketing is for.
Unconventional ideas that change the world we live in.
AI is everywhere, with venture capital pouring in.
From Elon Musk,
he took a massive axe and swung it through Twitter's workforce.
To Taylor Swift,
she is unstoppable as her Eras Tour stimulated local economy.
Your favorite coffee shop down the street to the vacation house you rented last weekend. Whatever business means to you, Wondery is the destination for business podcasts. Listen to top business shows like How I Built This, Business Wars, The Best One Yet, Business Movers, and many more. Everything from top daily news.
There was more ranch dressing sold last year than ketchup and barbecue sauce.
We're buying the dip, literally.
To deep dives on the biggest successes and failures of our time.
20,000 people lost their jobs.
Wondery means business.